Hello and welcome to Cycle Systems Academy podcast. This week I've got an incredibly fascinating guest who at first look you may not think is someone from the bike industry, but is actually reasonably well connected in the bike industry, and also whose worldview and world experience I think is really, really exciting and really great to bring to everyone's attention. So Hani Rashid, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Sean. It's a pleasure, great pleasure to be here with you.
So for anyone listening who's not heard of you or doesn't know what you do, give us like a quick background, both of cycling and your broader life. Who are you? What are you all about?
Yeah, I'm an architect. I practice here in New York City. I grew up in an art family, I guess you could say, in Canada. In Toronto, to be specific, and I became an architect kind of out of an interest in film and photography, and that actually was driven by my youth growing up playing hockey. What I didn't know was a version of BMX biking, because we were sort of making it up as we went along back then. And road cycling, which I started doing, but didn't get into other than just sort of playing around with my Bottecchia that I loved. And then basically I kind of spent a lot of time on my bike photographing and filming. And then that kind of got me sort of into what I would do with my life, you know, and I kind of went to applied some architecture schools, started realizing that maybe there's something in architecture that could actually be of interest to me. And my portfolio, ironically, was made up of photographs taken from my bike. So somehow, you know, became an architect. I've done, you know, lots of stuff in and around our art discipline and urban planning and design. You know, we venture all over the map, sort of. We do a lot of art installation work. We work with the art world a lot. And then somehow, in some strange, circuitous way, I've made my way back to my passion for cycling within the profession, within the discipline, which is kind of interesting and unexpected and delightful.
So for anyone that doesn't know, you can look up Hani on Wikipedia and elsewhere. And Hani, it's only fair to say you're probably one of the world leading architects, and some of the buildings you designed have been incredible, sort of cutting edge. Essentially, the big thing with the bikes at the moment is we've got the Pinarello New York bikes that have come out and led by yourself. So where did the connection from Pinarello come from, basically?
It's actually a very curious thing that happened. I was actually working a couple of years ago with Pirelli, the tire manufacturer, and I was meeting with them in Milan. We were working on a kind of, because we do also in our work some product design and some co-branding or branding stuff. So we were talking to Pirelli about the way they could maybe resituate their brand, and they have such a powerful brand, which obviously in Formula One is a super brand. And we thought, you know, maybe the sport world, we could do some kind of tying with Pirelli on the sport world. And we started talking about, of course, they had their new Zero tires coming out for cycling. They were bringing back their kind of pedigree with cycling, which they had, you know, of course, very, very strong history with. And I, with my team in New York, we started to branch out a little bit from that and proposed interesting co-branding scenarios for them. And even to the point where I started designing a bike for them from ground up, that maybe we could sort of, you know, then the thought was, why don't we go talk to Pinarello, because they were actually on their way there to talk about tires. And so I tagged along on that meeting, and I'll never forget that meeting. I was sitting there in Treviso with Fausto Pinarello and Luciano, and they were pitching, you know, tires, of course, because that's what they do. And then they kind of looked at me like, "What's that guy doing sitting in the room?" And I just said, "Well, here, let me show you what I've been thinking." And I started showing a document which was really about, you know, about cycling and about Pinarello and about from the point of view of pedigree, culture, You know, even the poetry and the kind of artistry of cycling, as which is really my passion, and I started talking very much about also how the Pinarello brand itself, you know, has this fantastic pedigree, of course, back to Fausto's father, and within the Giro and within all the Italian, you know, sort of racing and so on. And I said, you know, it's just kind of an honor to be sitting here talking to you guys, because really what you do here is not necessarily just create, you know, world-class bikes for, you know, the top teams in the world and sort of the top tier, sort of, you know, let's say technologies and so on, but you're also really a piece of culture, and a piece of really the Italian story also in terms of you know, elegance, proficiency, beauty, poetry, and so on. Now, I was doing this kind of, you know, I kind of got into my zone and did this presentation. And when I finally came out of my kind of delirium, I looked over and the Pirelli people were not terribly happy with me because I kind of just went off into this place that wasn't really the purpose for being there. But, you know, what happened was Fausto and Luciano became extremely interested in what I was saying to them, because I think it was refreshing for them to hear, especially from another discipline, which, like you said at the beginning of this podcast, is not necessarily something you would immediately put in line with something like cycling or with sport, or even with sport design, which is my discipline, which is architecture, which if you really sort of take it holistically, architecture is really about spatiality. And so when I started talking about the whole spatiality of their brand, and the power of what they do, that became the beginning of a great conversation and a great friendship actually with them. Since then, interestingly enough, I got dropped like a lead balloon by Pirelli coming out of that meeting. But you know, it wasn't really. You know, I realized that they have their strengths and they do what they do very well, and it wasn't really their interest to kind of branch too far out from their core competency, which is really tires. So, you know, then the conversation continued, and since then, you know, I've been to Treviso quite a few times, once with you, which was great, and we've also discussed other things beyond bikes, like you know, a passion I have for Pinarello in particular, for the company, is to somehow bring all of those remarkable relics from previous Giros and Tours and Criterions and sort of races. And the world of cycling into one place, which could be a kind of museum, which is of course one of my specialties as an architect, but into a kind of museological space, to really allow people to dig into the depth and the power of cycling from a cultural point of view, and that's just something I think that the cycling world really, you know, has at its doorstep, but for some reason is not necessarily always, you know, brought to the fore. It tends to this. If you look at all cycling press and all cycling kind of, let's say, you know, noise around the notion of cycling, it tends to fall in a couple of categories. Like, of course, it's health, and of course, it's technology. But you know, it kind of stops short of saying, look, it's really probably one of the most, if not the most, compelling sort of pastime / sport / technological sort of, you know, thing, I guess you could say, tied to the human condition, tied to cities, to landscapes, to, you know, to just, you know, being human. It's amazing that way. It's such an all-encompassing world. So I kind of went at it from that point of view, and that's the conversations we've been having together. So since then, there was this idea that, you know, we were going to do a flagship store for Pinarello here in New York City, and we started working on that, and we did quite a beautiful environment for them. However, though, it became a co-branding environment with other great brands like Specialized and ASOS. We were a little too Pinarello, I think, focused. And so that went out of our grasp, the store, which is now open, which is Strictly's, which is a terrific space. But we said, you know, why don't we put forward a special bike edition also for, you know, maybe for charity as well, and for auctioning and so on, that would be designed co-designed, I would say, with me, sort of at the helm. And then that's when I began to work with Treviso and with Fausto and others to produce a special edition bike, let's say. And we did an edition of 10. They're available now. I think a couple went off on auction. That's how that went.
Let's dive into the bikes shortly because they're really fantastic looking. We've had some great comments about them with the pictures on social media. And I would love to see you design a Pinarello museum because, like yourself, going to the Pinarello factory in Treviso, it is fascinating to see these bikes, like antique bikes from, you know, the very early days of bike racing, right through to Bradley Wiggins' Hour Record bike and everything in between. And they're all just hung up in a line, aren't they? Covered in dust.
They're actually rubbing each other. I was like, can't we just separate these a little bit?
Yeah. Miguel Indurain's bikes from the Tour de France, you know, those amazing time trial bikes. So obviously they're dying to get into a museum. And like you say, the cultural, historical, artistic aspect of cycling, I think, is one of the big draws. I mean, it's how Rafa established itself as a brand. It was to, you know, really get into that emotion and mystique and passion people have. And obviously, any bike company would do well to do that as well. But before we get really geeky into the bikes, which we love to do, I just wanted to take a step back a bit and look at your background, which is quite, I think, uniquely interesting because you were born in Cairo to, I assume, an Egyptian father, English mother, but you grew up in Canada. Mm-hmm. And doing a little bit of background reading myself for recording the podcast, I saw that your brother Kareem is also world leading in his field, which is in industrial design. Yeah. So essentially, you know, you've got two brothers, both of whom are fantastically successful at what they choose to do. Was there something about your upbringing, you said it was an artistic family, that made you both able to be so successful, or is it just happenstance?
Things are always subject to chance, but I think it's interesting when I think back, I try and sometimes ask myself the question and think about it. And, you know, my father was a full and true artist. And by that I mean someone who really lived, breathed, and worked within the art world in a very powerful way. He studied in Paris in the 50s with some very important masters. He then branched out and became an abstract expressionist painter and did some ceramic work and sculpture. And then when we emigrated to Canada, I was 7 or 8 years old, he took on stage set design and theater and television stage set design, as well as continuing to paint. So, you know, we grew up in a pretty passionate atmosphere around, especially around visual art and visual culture. My mother, being British and being somewhat of a bookworm and more literary, was really someone who was much more interested in, or really brought to me at least, a passion for language, for literature, for philosophy even. And so that was an interesting mix to have growing up, and also two very different cultures, the Egyptian side and the British side. And it was interesting because if they ever had a squabble, we heard a lot about history. and they both had lots to say, but that was really the milieu or the kind of environment. I guess there are a couple of events along the way that maybe pushed my brother and I to be hopefully in a healthy way competitive and to both strive for excellence. And those were things like, well, I think the most interesting event, at least in my memory, was my father. We were living in London. I started school in London, in primary school, and my father was having, even though he was extremely educated and very, very well-rounded, he was having trouble getting work because he had started to do stage set design and he wanted to work with the BBC. And I'll say this carefully, but there was a kind of a, I don't know if I want to say racist, but there was a kind of a xenophobia, let's say, that was part of the makeup there. My father felt a little frustrated that he couldn't get traction as an Egyptian-born, European-educated artist. And so he one day said to my brother and I even remember it because I remember the part, the little place we lived in, and it was, you know, sort of over breakfast, because he was the one kind of looking after us while my mother was actually working at that time. And he said, you know, we're gonna move to the new world. And my brother and I looked at him quizzically. New world? What's the new world? And we lived in a kind of walk-up in London, you know, sort of old 18th, 19th century district, right? And so he said, yeah. And he says, your mother's already flown there, but I'm going to take you two on a boat to go there. Like, okay, so, you know. And then we spent 7 days on the sea, you know, going to the quote-unquote new world. Now, my brother and I were, like, you know, fascinated by this. I had a little brownie camera, I remember very well. My brother was also, like, you know, completely wide-eyed and bushy-tailed. We had little, like, drawing contests on this boat. It was, like, this whole strange event. But then what effectively happened was we landed in Montreal, and my father took us straight to Expo 67. And Expo 67 was, like, unbelievable, awe-inspiring. I mean, here I was, a seven-year-old kid, whatever I was at the time, with my little brownie, taking pictures of, Buckminster Fuller's Dome, of monorails, we're riding through the Russian Pavilion, Sputnik was hanging there, there were these crazy, beautiful pieces of architecture that I didn't know as a kid what Buddha had done them, but I found out later, people like Carlos Scarpa and other very important architects. So it was like, really, the new world, and I was in shock, and I thought, how did we leave that weird 19th century life, you know, 7 days ago over the sea and arrive here? And then my father said, okay, let's go home. And we went home and we went to a walk up in Montreal that looked exactly like the place in London. And I said to him, whoa, wait a minute. I thought we were in, you know, it's kind of a weird shock. And I think, honestly, if I look back on that event, maybe for my brother and I, it became deeply sort of embedded into our synapses that the new world is possible, that there is a future that we could potentially create. I think both of us took it in our own way that you know, we were like in love with this idea, this fascinating, potential for the new. And off we went into our lives, obviously in our careers. We both chose disciplines, I think, that we thought we could, and we are, and I think we are, making a sort of impact on what that world could and look like and is. So that's I think, probably the most important moment in my childhood that I can remember that kind of pushed me dramatically towards a state of desire for something, a state of yearning. And so, you know, happened to be for me in architecture. And I think every day, you know, when I wake up and start drawing something or designing something, I'm trying to design, what I imagine to be an absolutely beautiful and powerful new world.
Well, that's certainly insightful, and it really, you know, touches me very deeply to hear you talking about, you know, your parents' artistic life, because obviously during COVID, you know, we're recording this in October 2020, and the way different countries have responded to funding the arts is incredibly stark. So, you know, Britain has literally just told the artists to go and retrain, you know, go and be a coder, just nothing, no support at all. Whereas other countries like France and Austria have given billions upon billions upon billions to the arts because they seem to recognize the wider social impact of the arts. It isn't just for people who want to go to the ballet or to, yeah, you know, to appreciate a painted picture. It's about the impact it has on all of the individuals touched by it and what may become of that. And that's what really spoke to me when you described that, Hani. So your architectural work then is very famous for fusing architecture and computer technology to make this hybrid style. And some of the buildings that I've seen that you've developed have looked completely out of the natural world as well, incredibly flowing organic designs. So did you take a similar kind of approach to your work with Pinarello for the Pinarello bikes then?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because in bike design, it's sometimes difficult to articulate the kind of radical procedures that one would do necessarily in a building. I mean, in a building, like when we did the Yas Hotel in Abu Dhabi for Formula One, you know, that building was like, it was an amazing journey because when I started designing that, I moved immediately into our digital technologies, the things that we were very good at doing. And we immediately actually modeled, we used a simulation Mercury, sort of with all the sort of, you know, kind of liquid dynamics, let's say, to design a housing for a building that would in fact evoke speed, technology, Formula One auto body design, and the kind of poetics of F1, because I looked at it from the point of view of, yes, it's a crazy technological sport, it has incredible sort of aura around it in terms of the automotive world, but really at the end of the day, a building that's sitting on the track and where we proposed immediately the cars should go through that building, which is what we did, it should really be modeled on a sort of liquidity and evoke that when you look at the building, whether you look at it in a still image, whether you drive around it and actually if you ride your bike around it, which they do, the building actually evokes all those beautiful sort of, let's say, I can say sort of carefully, but the DNA of that particular sport, but also just movement and the spirit of, you know, we actually used a wind tunnel to design that building, which sounds really strange, but we put our model into a virtual wind tunnel, and it allowed us to produce the flows and vectors and geometries around that form. And that's how you have the Yas Hotel. And today it stands as a kind of, you know, with all of that story behind it. On the bike side, because it's a more, you know, discrete object and it's not so obvious, what changes one could make to it. And we didn't want to, you know, purposely, of course, and the more I talk with I didn't want, it's a UCI bike, right? It's a UCI. So it wasn't about going in there and changing the geometry or changing the technology so much. So what we wanted to do was, similarly, we took the bike frame into our computers and I started to sort of digitally remap the geometries and the engineering of the frame back onto the frame. So it became a sort of reverb. It was like writing a piece of music in a way. It was kind of a reverb on the existing structure. And if you look carefully at the kind of patterning and tattooing and coloration that we ended up sort of applying to the finishes or to the I would say quote unquote the architecture of the geometries and coloration of the frame, it's actually the bike talking to itself. It's actually the radius around, you know, around the pedal movement, the sort of sweep left from the, you know, the rear wheel as one would extend the geometry into the frame. It's the sort of movement of the road. Even we actually texture map the road or the roadway back up into the frame itself. So it's actually absorbing the asphalt as part of its patterning. And you know, this is all, you know, maybe to someone out, people out there who are really into bike and bike technology might sound all a little bit like crazy sort of, you know, head in the cloud stuff, but it was really a fascinating kind of journey to sort of be figuring out how to work the bike in such a way that it actually somehow, almost in a kind of chameleon way, works with its environment and becomes sort of, I'll say this word we used, symbiotic with the actuality of the bike. So the actuality of the bike is to move through space, to whether it's climbing or descending, whatever it's doing, is to be within landscapes, to be within cityscapes. It has all these lives. And so we kind of said, well, you know, can we find a way to market with these lives? And so, you know, that became the genesis of it, or sort of the way we went about it. And then came with Manuel Bottega, who's great, who's a graphic sort of brand guy that works for Pinarello. We worked together on saying, okay, well now that we have the sort of geometries, what paints do we apply? What are the, you know, and it's not just a matter of color, but, you know, they have their whole My Way color sort of repertoire, let's say. But we looked for paints that would mix between matte and the sort of iridescent colors, and then allow them to operate together within this sort of, you know, within this whole sort of parable or this whole story of mapping. And so the result, and it's interesting because I look at these things on Instagram or on pictures and so on, but the difference when you see the actual bikes is dramatic, because these bikes never stand still because of the iridescent paints moving against the matte paints, moving against the patterning, moving against the geometry of the bike, moving against the other materials on the bike, the rubber versus, you know, carbon and so on. So it's actually kind of interesting because they became, and I don't want to lift them too high up, but they're kind of, you know, they're almost sort of works of art in a way, but they're like sculptures or paintings, and this goes back to my father, of course, but they are functional works of art. They are, they are, like I said, UCI sort of standard, high-end road bikes. And I rode one last weekend, upstate. And I, you know, maybe just because I'm an architect, I'm a little bit crazy. But as I looked down at the bike, because I was riding, I was like, wow, it's kind of working. These are things I think all cyclists see and recognize and enjoy, but we don't know how to articulate them so much, which is, and it's what I mean by the poetry, like just the sort of the glistening of a slightly wet road kind of reflecting up on the frame, or the sort of reflection, the quick reflection of trees and sun coming through some trees sort of hitting the frame and hitting the bike and hitting you. And, there's just all of these sort of phenomenological things that happen in sight when we ride bikes, whether we're riding leisurely or even, you know, maybe when you're all out racing, you don't notice any of that, of course, but anywhere in between, it's part of the joy. It's the joy of the sport. It's what makes it so unbelievably beautiful. The bikes are trying to be in dialogue with that. They're trying. And I think, interestingly enough, from the reactions I've seen, people are, they like this and they gravitate towards not knowing why. It's not as if you say, oh, I like that bike, intellectually because it did all the things I just described. No, it's not, nothing to do with it. At the end of the day, and it's the same thing that works for architecture, at the end of the day, it's your, we put all of this thought behind the things we do so that people who receive our work, the public, or whether it's a building or this bike or anything else I do, impose their own sort of values and biases and readings on it. But if we load the dice correctly, if we spend enough time intellectually and artistically getting the thing, getting the results to what we want, the readings are always so interesting because people, it's like listening to music. You don't know how someone composes or writes a piece of music necessarily. You don't know everything that's in their head. But if the music resonates with you at the end, it becomes your music. You then take it into your being, into your psyche, and you appreciate it because it resonates with something with you. Same thing goes for, you know, architecture. Same thing goes for design. Same thing goes for everything around us. So that's really the sort of, the sort of ideas behind this thing. But at the end of the day, the fact that people are taking and are sort of enjoying this. And I mean, I got a note from a friend of mine here in New York who went to Strictly's to look at the bike and wrote me back that it just kind of, and it sounds like a cliche, but he said it really spoke to him. And I thought, okay, that's what we're after. We're after this kind of, that it resonates with your, let's say, with your desires and your, your being, that somehow it's part of you. And that's, I know it sounds very, very high and highfalutin to talk about a bike this way, but I think you see it often. You see the amount of sort of bike kind of fetish sites and the sense of how much people love their bikes and paint their bikes and show their bikes against landscapes and show their bikes, because it becomes part of you. It's an extension of you in the world. That's really what that's what this was all about.
I think every cyclist relates to that. I mean, bike mechanics have, you know, fetishize about their toolkits, never mind the bikes, you know, but a lot of people's bikes have names, don't they? And, you know, when a bike gets stolen, it's a big deal. It isn't just an object. It's something really meaningful. Guys, if you're listening to this, hannyxpinarello.com is where you want to go with an I. And that's got everything about the project. It's about the bikes being auctioned off for World Bicycle Relief, which is an amazing charity which harnesses the power of bicycle to change people's lives, which again, if you ride a bike, you can understand how bikes can change people's lives. And also the fact that 10 replica bikes are actually going to be sold, you know, through Pinarello dealers as well. So incredible looking machines just on the, you know, just on the computer screens. I can only imagine in real life. And of course, as you say, actually being ridden with the world moving around you and the elements, etc. So again, just coming back to yourself then, because these are very much kind of New York bikes, aren't they? And you're based in New York now. And is there any particular reason for your base in New York? Was that a professional decision? So for my company, we set up in London initially just because the streets were paved with gold and that was a good place to launch a business. Or are you in New York for, again, that historical kind of field, you know, the place, cultural side of the place?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we tried to set up, when I did Asymptote, my office, it began in Milan. I'd finished school. I'd done my graduate school training here in America and then moved and started an office in Milan because I wanted to be in the kind of, what I saw as a kind of, in the center of a kind of cultural milieu. I wanted to have museums around me and intellectuals and creative people and artistry and history. And I thought Milan was the place for me at that time. And there I was, you know, plunked in Milan as a kid, really 20, 26 years old, whatever I was, trying to set up an architectural practice. And a design practice. And we did some work for, at that time, we did some runway shows for the fashion world and things like that. But what I realized after, you know, a couple of years of really struggling over there was that it wasn't what it was all cut out to be. It was really run by a very small group of Milanese architects who basically controlled everything. And if you were a Spanieri, as we were called, you were kind of like, you know, eyebrows were raised, and it's like, who's this kid, this Egyptian-British kid from, you know, Canada who went to school in the States? What's he doing here in our city trying to start an architectural practice? And that kind of like, you know, I could feel it, and I could feel the difficulty. And then I talked to some friends of mine, and I realized that all the studios in Milan at that time, all the important studios, had under them really talented foreign people, Dutch and Germans and British and, you know, Italian, Canadians and so on. But they were all the young designers fueling these practices. And it was really hard to get traction and to become a practitioner in your own right. So I met a very important French critic, art critic at the time. His name was Pierre Astini, who, you know, called me into a coffee. He said, let's have a coffee together. He had heard about me. I was this, you know, this kind of rambunctious young guy running around Milan with his portfolio thinking he could, you know, do important things. And so Pierre called me into a little meeting, and I had a meeting and a coffee. I'll never forget it because the guy was the sort of top intellectual critic in the European art and architecture world, mostly in art, actually. And he had this massive beard that went down to his belly, and his belly was big. And we sat in a coffee shop, and there was coffee dripping down his beard. And he was saying to me in his French accent, you know, Hanny, if you really want to make this work important, you need to get out of here right now and go work in either Paris or New York. which was kind of a shock for me because I was like, you know, wow, I thought I came here to sort of do things. And yeah, and then Lisanne Couture, my partner at the time, my girlfriend, you know, she said that she didn't like Milan either and that she was going to move to New York anyway, where she'd gone to Yale. So I said, you know what, why don't we go set up our practice in New York together? And that's how it started, and we came here. And I think what immediately occurred to me working here, and it's still the case, despite what you might read in the news about New York falling apart or, you know, all this post-COVID stuff, was that it's a true melting pot and a true kind of, I remember a friend of mine once said to me on a plane when we looked over Manhattan skyline, he said, it's and this is a while ago, it's the new Rome, all roads lead here. And in my world, architecture, design, and so on, a lot of roads lead here and go through here. I started to realize that this is really where I had to work. It really didn't matter where I came from. It really didn't matter what my, what my heritage is. It didn't matter what my education was, quite frankly. It wasn't so much about which school I went to. It was really about what you produce. Because what I realized as a kid working here was that, and I came up with this theory that New York is like a body and it's full of antibodies. And now the theory is more interesting, of course, in COVID. And that what you do when you come here as a young creative person, as a young person in any industry or in any world, everybody tries to push you out. It's a constant, you're constantly up against people who say, nope, you can't do it. It's not possible. You should go somewhere, there's this constant, but that pushing, that constant, punching bag makes you pretty damn strong. And so if you can get into the stream here, creative, at least in the creative arts, what I do, and put up with enough sort of resistance, there's a payoff. Unlike Milan, where the resistance was just going to drive you down, it felt like. We set up here. We did a lot. We had a very successful early competition when we were still in our late 20s to build a big project in Los Angeles for a kind of monument to the West Coast. And that set us off on our careers here and our practice.
A bit like your parents before you, you went to the new world to start the new life.
I told you, I'm in the constant quest for the new world, whether it's...
So here's this Egyptian British kid who grew up in Canada in New York in October 2020, just weeks away from a pivotal election, which will probably change the future of America one way or another. So what's it like for you on a broader sense living in the USA right now?
Well, it's daunting. I mean, if you look at what's going on around New York and the rest of the country, it's a little precarious. I mean, handled this COVID thing horribly, this country has. There's been, there's a lot of aggressive behavior. There's factions. There's things that I never dreamed I would witness. I remember growing up and listening to my father talk about Egypt during Cultural Revolution, during way before the Cultural Revolution, during his time, where there were dictators and police takeovers and all this stuff. And he left that. That's why he went to Europe. That's why he got out of that craziness. And so to somehow be sitting here in this time, you're right. I mean, to be sitting here in this time, looking at a political and even economic situation that might drive some pretty dramatic things going on is daunting to say the least. On the other hand, and I'll say this carefully, and this is New York is not really America, and what I mean by that is that there are so many people here, again, from everywhere, who brought a lot of their culture to this place, which is what makes it such a fascinating, much like London, I think, in that sense. And I think that we watch the way our politicians work and the governor here and so on. And we are at the moment sort of, in that flattened curve scenario, in terms of COVID at least, and have certain, big things to solve, economic and otherwise. But the resilience of this place can't be underestimated, and I think I'm actually in a weirdly optimistic state of mind about this city and about the future of this country, even to tell you the truth, and the future of the planet to be more which is really where my real focus is. Yeah, it's a strange time we're all living through and seeing, but it's also a kind of, one could take it from another point of view, and this is maybe, they say that optimism is in the gene pool, it's in our genes if we're optimists, and I think that I keep looking at the silver lining of everything that's taking place here. And to put it in very blunt terms, and you're in Switzerland, so you know what this word means. it's a kind of cleansing, a strange cleansing that we're watching take place. And the question is how we deal with it and what we do when we come out of it. So, and there are little indications of that that are so interesting to me. For example, I live in Brooklyn and I look out over Manhattan and the East River. And I'm kind of amazed in the mornings to go outside and have my coffee and to have oxygen everywhere. There's no pollution. There's no airplanes flying over my head. It's kind of weirdly calm and serene. And then if I go on my bike and I go out and I like going, we bike here in the Hudson Valley. It's heavenly. It's perfect. It's remarkable. There are not as many cars on the roads. The air is clean and so on. And what I mean by that is that, I'm wondering if, and this is a global question, for those of us who, are privileged enough to be enjoying this, because it's not for everyone, of course, there's a lot of strife and problems, but the point is, if we are taking in stride and understanding and appreciating completely what it means to bring the environment back to a place where it actually is healthy, bring the world back to a pace which is actually healthy, not as frenetic and insane as it was prior to this. Because we talk about global warming, but the other thing to talk about is sort of the overheating of the way the world was being treated by humankind, the way we are dealing with everything from the environment, from fossil fuels, from the way we urbanize, the way we design our cities, the way we design our buildings. And there's a lot of, it's really a very interesting moment to really kind of say, okay, we're in a reboot situation. We have a situation where we are, clean, in some ways it's a tabula rasa. It's a kind of we could think of it as a restart, a reboot, a reinitiation. And what do we do when we come out? Are we going to go back? Is it going to, am I going to go back to crazy, insanely packed airports and airplanes, that are darting around the world sort of meaninglessly because now we can do meetings through Zoom or other scenarios? Will I be sort of not able to have to step outside of my home in any city I live in and gag on the pollution? And the question is, it goes on and on. So I think that if we can and we're able to say, what is it that we're now getting a reappreciation of on every level? And what do we do when we reinitiate? Do we just go back to business as usual? Or do we actually use this as a circumstance and a time and a window to take a really careful look at ourselves and what we expect from that future? So my new world that we talked about at the beginning of this has changed. I've redefined what this new world has to be, as far as I'm concerned, by virtue of the things I'm experiencing and seeing. And I think it is an important moment for us to reflect and to use it for that. If we don't use it for that, it's been a big waste and a massive hit, let's say.
Well, you answered my second question in the first one there, which is always nice. And it already has happened, hasn't it? If you look at, Paris, to a lesser extent, London, entire areas have been closed to the motor car and bicycle, as well as walking and such, is being put in its place. So permanent changes are being made. And as you say, the opportunity here is huge. And I remember when I was in my 20s and there was another Sean actually who worked on a project I was part of, and he was a designer, and he was really, really obsessed with using his design to create a new world, a world in harmony with nature, a world that didn't pollute and destroy and exploit. And he said, when he was studying design, all of the big masters would say to him, well, I don't do green design. And he'd say, as if it's a choice, as if it's an option, as if it's like what color you like, rather than surely has to be the most central tenet to everything that we do. So your educational resume is equally impressive as to everything else. And you're currently professor at the University of Applied Arts in Vienna. So do you think this new world, this new world, is going to really influence your teaching and teaching of architecture?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I run a lab in Vienna. We call it Deep Futures Lab. And actually, now we're calling it Urban Futures Lab. Because we've been focused, 7 years now there. I've been focused with my students and my teaching assistants on interrogating and reassessing. And this was pre-COVID, of course. We've been looking at, we had Audi as a partner on one project where we were looking at the idea of building, what it would be like to design cities that are tethered together by automated electric vehicles. And we actually, in that project, we developed a bunch of scenarios for cities of the future, which are in fact cellular-based, tethered environments that are based on time lags, time periods it would take to sit in a vehicle and be shuttled to another place by virtue of auto drive. And then that other place would contain certain universities, for example, or schools, or another place is actually entertainment, or another place is another kind of aspect of urban life. And you could, in fact, we showed how you could have city space spread over 500 kilometers and basically live in a kind of, in a different symbiotic relationship with nature by virtue of producing an entirely different typology for urban space. And urban life, and one that privileges the environment and privileges, the well-being of the planet. We've been doing crazy research and all that. We just finished, and it was weirdly timed. We had started a whole study on the future of hospitals and how we should think about medical care and aging. And we had started that pre-COVID, and it became extremely intense during COVID because most of that work was being done over Zoom with all of my students and research assistants. And we produced some pretty interesting scenarios for, urban hospitals that would actually, evolve according to crises and then sort of, regroup and retrench themselves in terms of space, in terms of down periods and so on, and very quickly deployable and all this sort of thing. So yeah, it's great. And I've always, I started teaching also around the same time I described that other story when I first came to New York. I started teaching at Pratt back then, and then I became a professor at Columbia University for quite a while. Then I went and taught at Princeton and Harvard, and eventually, took on this program in Vienna, and it's always been incredible. And I think you can relate to this very much. It's been so important to run in parallel in my world, my practice, to run in parallel research and to work with, really nimble, sometimes very smart and much smarter in a way, younger minds that are able to, quickly sort of get through issues and problems and do research, because you can't necessarily do that by just sitting on the sidelines and only doing what it is you do. You need this kind of interplay between academics and work. So yeah, it's really, really important. And the nice thing about Vienna and the Angewandte or the University of Applied Arts is that it's basically a kind of art school, sort of structured a little bit like an art school, but it's really a place where I'm given complete freedom as a researcher, as a professor. So with my 40 students, they work with me for 3 full years from the beginning, and they come with different interests. In fact, I just had a student who was a cyclocross champion or very good, strong cyclocross guy, and it was really fun to work with somebody who with students who have other passions and bring it to our discipline and have this kind of different take on why we create space, why we create architecture, why we create, again, these new worlds.
Well, that brings me in a beautiful circle right through to the last question, which brings us back to bikes, which is how you and I got connected in the first place. So just to talk about your riding experience, Hanny, like you mentioned, riding in the Hudson Valley, where do you love to ride? What are your most treasured routes?
So we, Lizanne and I, Lizanne is my partner, she should also be mentioned here. She was a freestyle, she was on the Canadian national freestyle team when I met her as a skier. And she took to bike, she took to cycling before I did. She was actually quite an avid cyclist. In Europe, when I moved to Milan, she was actually having a great time in Tuscany and in the south of France, with doing road cycling at a very serious level. And what happened was, we kind of realized, and I had an earlier interest, that when we sort of looked for a place to spend our summers, we found a place in La Marche in Italy. That is up it's a priest house and up on the mountain, 300 meters up from a valley, and there's fantastic cycling there, and that became, we actually got the place because of cycling. We got the place because it has a space where I can keep my bikes. It's a place where I can, literally, as many of us love to do in this aspect, literally, get on in the morning and clip in and off I go into some of the most beautiful landscapes I've ever known. And this is all around Urbino and Pesaro. It's where the Giro went through yesterday, I think, or the day before. The Giro didn't pick the right tracks, though. I was looking at watching it live, and I was like, why are they like on the coast? Because inland from Rimini and these places, and Cavice Mare, where they were yesterday, is some of the most beautiful cycling in Italy. And maybe in the world. So yeah, that's a major place for me. And I've got this mission to basically mark every route I can on Strava around there to create an entirely colored map of the area. Mm-hmm. Because my son now, who's 23, who's a very strong cyclist and has taken on as a big passion, is starting to redo my routes there. He's starting to sort of re-ride them, because he grew up listening to me talk about them, and so now he's kind of like trying to. So he's got blue lines on my orange map. That's a big place for us. But because of COVID, I discovered upstate New York, and I was pleasantly surprised at how remarkable the cycling is. Outside of New York City, because here I only really knew and for all New Yorkers who listen to this, the 9W Bear Mountain sort of trek. But I never really liked it, because it's, it's a wide shoulder, but you're still with traffic. But getting out of here a couple of hours out into the Hudson Valley, and you are really in, beautiful, beautiful part of the state, and some really amazing roads and cycling. Of course, there's also the Dolomites, which I will, hopefully I never need to actually buy an electric bike, but one day maybe when old enough, I need to still climb those mountains in the Dolomites, one would maybe need the help. But for now, it's also an absolutely perfect place from where I sit.
Well, certainly for those of us that have ridden in those areas, we can relate. And for those of us that haven't, it's inspiring, isn't it? And I think that's the great thing about cycling, is there's always a new route. There's always a new place to go. There's always a new world to take you on your bike. So, Hani, Rashid, an absolute pleasure to speak to you. Thanks so much for taking the time to come on the Cycle Systems Academy podcast. Where can people find out about you or find you online or social media?
So, first, John, it's been brilliant speaking with you, and I really appreciate it. You're actually a fantastic asset to this whole industry because of your passion. So thank you. www.asymptote.net is our website, ASYMPTOTE. The word asymptote, by the way, is a mathematical term for those who don't know, and is all about the converging of two parallel lines at a vanishing point, which I find is a kind of beautiful philosophical position as to what we're all trying to do here is get. It's about desire. So asymptote is about desire, and my own Instagram is it's a Hani_Rashid_architect on Instagram, and other social medias through there. But yeah, it's been brilliant speaking with you, and thank you so much. I look forward to riding with you soon, or seeing you at least, either in Switzerland or in England, or even over here, maybe. We never know.
Yeah, absolutely. When the borders open up and those positive thoughts are crystallizing into reality, we'll definitely do that, honey. So thanks again. Thanks for listening, everyone. And join us next week for another Cycle Systems Academy podcast.
If you want to break into the bike trade, train your staff, or even learn some new skills just for fun, Cycle Systems Academy has a course for you. Our graduates come to us from all over the globe and train with us to gain the highest recognised cycle mechanic qualifications available. The bike industry supports and believes in Cycle Systems Academy, which means they'll believe in you too.